Well, good afternoon and welcome, everyone. With Milstein Hall now in its first semester of operation, this is an especially auspicious time for Cornell to welcome Rem Koolhaas back to campus. Rem, welcome. This very striking building, designed by Rem's firm OMA, powerfully reimagines a site on our campus with several historic buildings in close proximity. Inspiring in its innovative development of the space, Milstein Hall enhances teaching and research in the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning, and gives a new visibility to art and design across our entire campus. Milstein Hall also offers new public spaces and what I consider an exhilarating point of entry at the north end of our central campus. Earlier this year, when Architectural Digest named Cornell one of 10 U.S. college campuses with the best architecture, the editors chose an image of Milstein Hall to illustrate Cornell's architectural milieu. Our thanks to Professor Koolhaas and many others at OMA for their commitment throughout a long design process in which they reacted to every challenge we threw at them with renewed creative invention. And our audience this afternoon are many members of the Cornell University Board of Trustees and Cornell University Council who have gathered here this weekend for the annual meetings. To you, our trustees and counselors, I offer a warm welcome back to Cornell and deepest gratitude for the support of many kinds that many of you have provided for Milstein Hall. I'm especially grateful, of course, to the Milstein family for their leadership in naming Milstein Hall and to the many other generous donors who made this building a reality. Your vision and your confidence brought to completion a much-needed structure that now brilliantly serves the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning while contributing superb contemporary architecture to the campus environment. Rem Koolhaas is a central figure in international architecture and design, acclaimed not only for the inventive buildings he has designed, but for his influential writings and exhibitions and planning projects that address central issues of culture and the changing use and the changing shape of our built environment. Born in Rotterdam and raised in the Netherlands and in Jakarta, he studied script writing before changing to architecture, which he studied at the Architectural Association in London and here at Cornell University in the early 1970s. It was here that he began writing Delirious New York, a retroactive manifesto for Manhattan, published in 1978, and still known today as a most influential text in architecture and urbanism. In 1975, he co-founded OMA, which today has offices around the world. Among their many accomplishments are the Netherlands Embassy in Berlin, the Seattle Central Library, the Casa da Musica in Porto, Portugal, and the China Central Television Headquarters in Beijing. Rem, I was once interviewed there. It's a very, very striking building. These and other OMA projects are currently the focus of a major retrospective at the Barbican Gallery in London. Throughout his career, Professor Koolhaas has continued to surprise us with unconventional projects, many developed through AMO, the research group associated with OMA. Among AMO's recent projects are a master plan for Russia's Hermitage Museum, as you know, a vast complex with a nearly 250-year history, an educational program for a new school of architecture in Moscow, and Roadmap 2050, a vision for zero carbon power grid for all of Europe. The work of Rem Koolhaas has garnered prestigious international awards, including the Pritzker Architecture Prize in 2000, and the gold medal that is a lifetime achievement award of the Royal Institute of British Architects. Professor Koolhaas teaches at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. He is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the European Council on Foreign Relations, and the French Legion of Honor. Please join me in welcoming one of the world's and one of our generation's most influential thinkers in the realm of architecture and urbanism, Rem Koolhaas.
Thank you very much. I named the lecture Progress, knowing extremely well that we don't believe in progress anymore, but suggesting to you how an office like ours is in a perpetual state of adjustment, responds very carefully to emerging situations, and is extremely contextual with the events in the world. And therefore, you should not expect a lecture with a climax or a very theatrical lecture that is about one subject. I simply want to give you a kind of glimpse in the mind of the office at this particular moment. I think everyone seeing this image knows that this is architecture, but you don't only know it's architecture, you also know that this is a building with which or through which a particular civilization expressed its values, and you also see that it is a public building. Since the 80s, we have been submitted to what we call the YES regime, the regime of the market economy, launched under Reagan, reaching at some point in the 80s the status of Washington Consensus, and seemingly unraveling at the current moment. And I think that this phenomenon, the YES regime, has had a very great impact on architecture, and everything we do is really related to that impact. So if this is architecture or was architecture, I think that through the market economy, this became architecture. And I think you can also all tell what the differences are. You can see that the level of individual expression has become infinitely stronger. You can also see that this is not necessarily a building that expresses shared values. It seems more a building that expresses a unique cluster of values. And for me, this is a kind of very important point of the architecture that we are producing at this moment. And it is also very important to realize that where this is a building for the public sector, even if it is a museum, the Guggenheim is clearly a building from dating and deriving from a private initiative. And so basically the shift from the public to the private, I think, has fundamentally changed the architecture we produce, and also fundamentally changed the what we expect from architecture. If you work for the public sector, you can automatically assume as an architect that you somehow serve the public. Working for the private sector, that is of course much more debatable and never particularly sure. With this shift toward the private, there has also been an incredible avalanche of attention directed to the architect, to the individual architects. Architects have become celebrities, as you can see here in the case of Peter Eisenman, at the center of a monument to the Jews that were deported from Germany, hounded by a group of paparazzi. And I think that this kind of hounded nature is an important aspect of the conditions under which architecture is produced today. There's also something very problematic about style and uniqueness, because although there is maybe a handful, let's call it maybe 10 architects who have reached the status of star architects, you also see that that status is constantly devalued simply by, this is Calatrava with a building, and 1 year later in Dubai, the same building is becoming basically a developer's proposition that is also realized and probably realized before Calatrava kind of realizes his building. So you see also that under the market economy, uniqueness evaporates and becomes distributed. So you know, all those, this is an analysis recently did, which for me is a very kind of funny illustration of what I'm talking about. This is the behavior of Wall Street. This is the 80s and the climax that we know happened in the early 21st centuries. And what we looked at is architects on the cover of Time magazines. And then you see that there were many architects in the 20s, a lot of architects in the 30s, architects in the 40s, architects in the 50s and 60s, but that the last architect ever on the cover of Time was Philip Johnson in 1979. So what does it mean? It simply means that what we produce draws much more attention, but is taken less seriously, and that we are not deserving of the honor that the Time magazine covers bestows. So this is a really pretty drastic effect of the market economy, I would say, on the status of architecture. And so all of us are caught in a wrenching moment of, on the one hand, prominence, but at the same time, a kind of eroding sense of relevance. What we together produce is this. What it kind of really suggests is that if you add our work, it doesn't add up to the collective effort that would make a city, but you get simply a kind of army of eccentric entities that have a kind of rather problematic coexistence. So if this is the context that we ourselves can work in, then perhaps the current moment, the crisis of 2008, will have one useful function, which is to erase this and to create an end of this particular period. If you look at Wall Street, that end seems to be kind of really imminent. And so what I will be showing tonight, and I try to do it at a breakneck speed, is simply what we are thinking at this moment and what is our own agenda, kind of partly defined to outwit this situation and also to explore territories on which we can be active in the future, so that we before not only work on architecture itself, but that we also kind of work on our own future. Now, in the show, in the Barbican that we recently opened, we had one room, current preoccupations, and so this is the format of the room. We simply wrote our preoccupations, illustrated it with a few images, and allowed the public to make their own books. And so this lecture tonight is similar. Anyway, in this wave of eccentricity, it is very clear that architecture ought to become more essentialist, more simple, not simplistic, but look less at form and more at performance. And in terms of the architecture that we are doing in the past couple of years, we were very aware that the crisis would emerge. Certainly in the year 2005-2006, we had a very uneasy feeling. So the building you see in Cornell is part of that kind of generation where we emphasize performance over form. The first one was here in Dubai. What do you do in the desert if you know that all the surrounding architecture will be the typical extravagant developer's architecture of the moment? We thought we could make a very strong statement. We proposed an enormous building, 900 feet tall and 600 feet wide, made out of white concrete. It consisted of offices, a hotel and housing, interrupted by four public spaces, demands, dedicated to art, business and other cultural facilities. and placed it in the center of a development, and were counting on the purity of this gesture to kind of suggest a new beginning. And we're also counting on the contrast of the surrounding architecture to give this gesture value. We made one further investigation. We made the building rotate every 24 hours so that it would avoid direct sunshine, so that was done for reasons of sustainability. When we finished the building, we were very happy that we ourselves felt we were making a new beginning. And so that was the beginning of a period that is still not over. This is a kind of similar building. It's a building for the new stock market in Shenzhen. It's again a very simple building. It's a tower and a podium. Typically the podium is on the ground, but here we lifted it off the ground so that with the same elements we create a kind of public space underneath the building. And also the building, by being lifted, proclaims the function of the stock market in Shenzhen and to the population of Shenzhen, where of course the stock market is a very crucial entity in terms of Chinese form of progress. The building is very robust, but clad in a very delicate glass skin that proclaims the events on the outside very efficiently. Another of these simple buildings is a building we recently completed for the Rothschild Bank in London. And what is the essence of all these buildings is that we are trying to offer, on the one hand, a kind of direct language, but within that language are also trying to be sensitive and are finding ways of accommodating certain things, certain values in the city. The City of London is, as you know, an incredible mess. This bank is in the heart of this mess. It's actually a very exciting situation because it is so crowded that no one will ever see the building in its entirety. You can only see fragments. We, for the Rothschilds, who of course didn't want to be very demonstrative and not want to kind of suggest that they were wasting money, we did a kind of Florentine palazzo, a new version of it. Here you see it, a grey building in a grey environment. But there is only one very specific and careful thing that distinguishes it from the rest. In this crowded environment, there are all kinds of remnants of the past. There is an old church by Wren and a churchyard. And instead of blocking this access, what we did, we lifted the entire building so that the ground becomes a manifesto about the richness of London's past. And that then becomes the compensating element of the otherwise straightforward quality of the building. So basically, you are in a very narrow alley, it widens up, and then there is a wide perspective that enables you to see in this totally claustrophobic environment this beautiful condition. And also everywhere in the building, the kind of presence of the church proclaims the richness of London's and England's history. Here you are on the roof of the building looking at the city. In this relatively critical period where we are very skeptical of the kind of form making of our colleagues, we try to go beyond form, and this is perhaps an example of how that could be done. This is for a museum in a city in the Middle East. Of course, the problem of many museums, and particularly museums that are not affluent, is display environment. Typically, a museum in those cultures is superb objects in relatively oppressive or primitive cages. What we were considering here is that perhaps We could make a museum entirely without form, but a museum that consisted of pixels or individual cells that were in themselves display environments. And that simply the museum then didn't have to have a kind of real form, but that it could be a field of these displays piled up in landscape-like situation, reminiscent perhaps of ruins, and that that kind of environment could in that way be a direct performance of a museum without the shape, the containment, and the heavy-handedness of a museum. It's one of the kind of projects which I think has a real value or is kind of genuinely new in the sense of abandoning the quest for form and trying to find something which is literally a pure performance, kind of regardless of architecture, you could almost say. Now, Cornell can only be understood, I think, in exactly this sequence of projects. You know that there was a competition held, and then the assumption was that the Rand building, which you all know, would go, and that this would be a landmark marking the northern entrance of the campus. We were very happy that we came on the scene later after that, and that the whole language of landmark was at that point had become slightly suspect. Rand had to stay. It seemed irresponsible to eliminate square feet while adding it. So Rand had to stay. And in this new situation, the role of the building could become more modest on the one hand, simply connecting these separate entities. So we started working with this modesty and proposed an enormous slab that would connect these buildings. Now, slabs, boxes, are considered the most solitary buildings on Earth. In America, you know exactly how solitary they can be. But it was a very interesting challenge to use the box, on the contrary, to be a contextual element. And so in Cornell, we have a box, it's called Studio here, but the box is resting on an artificial hill, and underneath that artificial hill, there is a communal space that can be used simply to test and display the intelligence of what is produced in this building. And then on the crest of the hill, there's an auditorium, which is almost a kind of found object and simply generated by the encounter of this slab and the hill. So each of these decisions was taken to create a kind of maximum economy and to make in this very pure encounter of two elements, two languages, the language of steel and the orthogonal, and the language of concrete and the more organic, to make in these two simple encounter a maximum of performance for the entire company. So here we see the space underneath the hill, the auditorium kind of resting on the hill in daylight, in principle. I think it's very important if you're a lecturer to be able to kind of relate to the outside world, the hill, and the box on the hill, which is also the connector. So the element which is typically not related to anything else became the connector between all the different moments. And then, so here you see the kind of reality, the current roof. Instead of the iconic, we were able to introduce the mysterious. And I think I would suggest that maybe the mysterious is also an interesting term for today. We are tired of the iconic. There is too much iconicity, and there is too little mystery. And given the fact that the dimensions of the box, we were able to create a kind of perspective like this one, where the box forms without being heavy-handed, without dominating, still a clear mark of the northern entrance. Despite the encounter of the hill with the box, the interior of the dome, the auditorium in the open air, with a curtain that creates darkness if wanted. It's a school of architecture, so the curtain is also a kind of architectural lesson of the 17th century. The space and the transparencies between the dome, the hill, and the box, and the kind of coexistence of these elements. So in all of this, it's not that we want to abandon or simplify kind of really what you can say in architecture, but we want to purify it in a certain way and at least say nothing which is kind of redundant. And at the same time, of course, again, because we work for our future architects, it was interesting to create something that also spoke of different architectures. Now, I want to go again, as I said, at breakneck speed to a number of other concerns. I've told you what the current architectural concerns of the office are. I now want to move to the concerns of our think tank, AMO. And our think tank is not a kind of pretentious entity, but it is simply something that enables us as architects to define our own agenda. There is something very ironic about the status of an architect. An architect may know a lot, but he or she is doomed to wait for another person to take the initiative and ask them to do something. It's a very frustrating condition because it means that you cannot, as an architect, develop your own initiative or develop your own agenda. And basically, what AMO enables us is to develop our own agenda and to look into the future and look forward and see where we think crucial enterprises are developing, where we think we could make a crucial contribution to a cause, or where we intuitively think that the relevant architecture is going to occur. One of the worlds is the art world, and basically these considerations are not all with good things or with good tendencies. We are also dealing with certain realities that are reaching such an incredible proportion that we know and predict that there will in the future be breakthroughs in these worlds. One of them is the art world, and one of the ironic and in a certain way sinister, but perhaps also exciting elements of the art world is that the scale of the accommodation for art is getting bigger and bigger. This is simply a scale of buildings in the Tate Modern, an enormous hall, but these are mostly former industrial spaces that are dedicated to become art spaces in the future. So multiples of the Tate, and the Tate is already enormous. So what are the effects of this kind of increasing scale? One of the effects is an almost explosive scale of art, which is uncharted territory, I would say. Nobody can kind of really capture this kind of art, and it's certainly not possible to capture it in the terminologies that we have traditionally used for art. You can, in a certain way, only surrender to it. This is Anish Kapoor in the Grand Palais in Paris. And this is in the Tate Turban Hall, a work by Olofsson, to which, again, you could only surrender. And personally, I feel that there is something almost authoritarian in this scale of art, and I am, as a person, not entirely comfortable with that authoritarian dimension. The bigness of the art simply overwhelms and has only one kind of response, which is awe. And maybe awe is not what the only emotion that one should feel for art. But On the other hand, I think it is also generating new and interesting potentials. Museums are becoming bigger and bigger, and that means that perhaps in the near future they should be not considered as architectures but as cities, or at least as quarters of cities. So that maybe you should not look at museums with the rules and the logic of architecture, but with the rules and the logic of urbanism. And once you do that, and this is a proposal we made in Beijing, for a city-sized museum, a museum so big that all the kind of vitality of a city, but also all the exchanges that are possible in a city and all the impermanence that is possible in a city, all the flexibilities that are possible, all the juxtapositions that are possible in a city can occur within the museum. So it's no longer the museum is a place of purity, but the museum is a kind of place of urban exchange. So that is one consideration that we are anticipating and that we are kind of beginning to work on. The other this is an image of China. Basically, you can probably know that China in the next 10 years will generate for almost from scratch a number of mega cities. The current definition of a mega city is maybe 10 million people. And so basically all these cities will grow from almost zero to 10 million in 10 years. So this has given us another agenda point. If the Romans were confronted with similar situations, what they did is kind of simply impose a single template on almost any environment and simply called the results city. And as we know, in spite of the generic nature of the template, simply by being imposed on different environments, different climates, different geographies, difference was generated in any case. So what we are now exploring with some of the kind of major industrial companies of the world is whether we cannot create a kind of metropolis starter pack where you could simply create an almost prefab definition of a center with all the kind of assorted infrastructure integrated from the very beginning, and could kind of simply impose that starter pack or sell that starter pack as the beginning of any of these new metropolises. So it is a kind of part of prefabrication almost, but not at the scale of furniture or the scale of the room or the scale of the house, but prefabrication on the scale of a metropolis. And this is, of course, a very daring hypothesis. We may be right, we may be wrong, but we think it's a very worthwhile effort to begin to think about what the nature of such a kind of ready-made center could be. The next preoccupation is a number of preoccupations that are actually interconnected and that are, for me at this moment, perhaps the most suggestive of all. I've called the process thinning, and there are many phenomena today where the area covered is increasing, but where the intensity of use is decreasing. And that sounds maybe a little bit abstract, but this is an example. This is Dubai. These are sold apartments, but you cannot really say that they're inhabited. They're so abstract that we first wanted to look for signs of life, but we didn't find signs of life, so then we started looking for irregularity. And irregularity could be some kind of flower in a window, or maybe an abandoned chair on a balcony. So here we found kind of points. These are the only points of irregularity we found in this picture. And so I would say this is an example of thinning. The city is there, it is there in all its physical might, but it is no longer inhabited like a city. It is, the population of it is making itself rare, And therefore, we have the physical symptoms of density, but it's at the same time an almost empty eroded social environment. This is another example. This is a village in Switzerland. This is the scale of the village 20 years ago. Since then, most of the population of this village has disappeared, so they've gone to the city. But in spite of the disappearance of the inhabitants, the village has expanded astronomically. And so it's another phenomenon of thinning. The footprint becomes enormous, but the way it is used and the moments it is used are becoming very rare. So it's a phenomenon that is not only happening in cities, but it's also happening on the countryside. And so what you get is the authentic world like this one, very beautiful with all the kind of symptoms of history, and then the kind of renovated condition or a simulated condition with which a village expands, which actually are typically holiday homes that are perhaps inhabited 2 or 3 weeks per year. And they need the incredible expansion of the village. This is a typical interior, so many cushions that you wonder what kind of pain these inhabitants have to accommodate. From thinning, I became more and more kind of interested in the countryside. And maybe it comes as a little bit of a shock because I've typically spent a lot of my career and obviously spent a lot of its energy in defining the condition of the city and the nature of the city to explore the nature of the new city. But I am in a way tired and bored with that. Everyone knows now that 50% of mankind lives in 2% of the surface of the earth. Those are the cities, and that basically they consume 75% of our energy and create 80% of our pollution. Here see the cities and landscape, but I am more interested now in the rest. And the rest is what the people that went to the city left behind. It's 98% of our planet, again 50% of the inhabitants, but that's diminishing very rapidly, and of course a fraction of the energy and the pollution. Now, this is that remnant, the kind of residue that we left behind. But that residue is drastically changing. Here it looks still authentic, but this meadow, and here you see, this is the statistic for the Netherlands, but in 20 years, the population of the countryside, which is true for the entire of Europe, went from 20% to 2, so decimated literally. Also a global trend. So if you look at the countryside, it's no longer the countryside, but a toxic mix of genetic experiments, science, industrial nostalgia, immigration, buying sprees of nations, massive subsidies, incidental inhabitation, tax incentives, investment, political turmoil, and class warfare. So actually, we see the countryside as a front line of change on which it is extremely important to focus at this moment. This is the beginning of the century, the countryside. It happens to be Russia, but it stands for the countryside now. This is Switzerland 100 years later, and these are domestics from Thailand and Cambodia who maintain this empty village now and who let out their pets and occasionally kind of play with the kids. A Swiss meadow now has a kind of high chance of being maintained by Sri Lankan labor. And of course, agriculture itself has become caught up with the kind of market economy to create phenomenal increases in price and phenomenal manipulations that creates now these kind of disconcerting announcements and an attraction of becoming farmers. Basically, in this movement, elements that we think are familiar, like a tractor, really acquire ominous properties. A tractor is now a highly technological element with dashboard and completely automated and sinister kind of memory. This is basically a field, and this is the yield of that field, computerized. These are the kind of things that can be done to change it, and so therefore the program of the computer is to avoid these kind of irregularities now. This is, for me, a totally fascinating picture. If I asked anyone here what it is, I hope you would think and say that it was an Indian worker in a newly energetic India working on the future. But unfortunately, that is not the case. It is an Indian farmer who helps to keep the milk in Italy flowing. So it's not only the fields, but also the cows and the kind of animals that are part of this completely kind of robotized environment. This is a kind of machine that scratches. It's very funny that you laugh. So I think I've dealt with the animals, dealt with the land. And here, this is an element of history where large sections of Tuscany are bought by tourist entities, 5 by 5 kilometers, and then kind of maintained. They asked the Italian inhabitants to stay in the villages and to maintain the fiction of Italian life, even though it is completely a tourist resort. So from the countryside, we move to the desert. The desert, there will be a lot more desert in global kind of warming. So we're looking at properties and qualities that we could invent and explore and establish in the desert. And this one I will skip. And then I will kind of end with two more, or three more. One is Europe. I'm a European, our office is European and also international, but I personally am continuing to invest a lot of intellectual capital in Europe, even though I know that it is a hopeless case. For me, this is a kind of excellent representation of Europe. It's a kind of house in Greece. And you know that the Greek people kind of buy typically the ground, build the ground floor and maintain the rebar so that in the future they can add another level. And for me, this is Europe. The previous generation built a solid base. But the current leaders are unable to complete the house. A deeply embarrassing kind of situation that on an individual level, I'm of course, and we are of course completely unable to address. But nevertheless, we are working for the European Union occasionally to try to create some kind of streamlining and some kind of coherence in the presentation, at least, of Europe. And one proposal we have made is that in these embarrassing political gatherings where Europe has to be represented by all of its 27 non-entities, that Europe itself falls on its sword and delegates a single person to be important and among the other important persons. We are also writing a history of Europe as a graphic novel, where, for instance, certain future ideas like a European army are. So basically, this is a case of watch this page. There are two more. There's one more thing I want to say. Education. I remain very interested in education. In a certain way, our office is an education institution itself. But what we are experimenting with in Strelka and Russia is the idea of a one-year graduate education. I have a feeling that in the near future, we will not be in a situation that around our 20th year, we acquire a dose of knowledge which will last us till our 60th. I think on the contrary, that it's much more likely that in an ideal situation, every 10-year period, you would be able to simply reacquaint a new body of knowledge. And that if that could be delivered in a year, that would be a very beautiful kind of prototype. So that is what we are working on in Russia, and hopefully introducing in the future on a greater scale in Europe. So that's one of the kind of future entities. And finally, we and I personally remain interested in books, not for the sake of books, but there are forms of understanding that can only be recorded in the format of a book. And basically, we just published a book, Project Japan, which is based on a series of interviews that I made with Hans-Urs Oberst, an obsessive interviewer from the art world, of all the remaining members of the metabolist movement, movement of architects in Japan. Why the metabolist? I was always fascinated by and aware early that the initiative in architecture, sooner or later, would be taken away from the West to the East. It is now the case in terms of quantity, certainly. By far the largest amount of new architecture is built in the East. But I also feel very strongly that intellectually, this initiative has to, sooner or later, be established there. And as a kind of announcement of that shift, the Japanese metabolist movements were, in a way, the first non-Western avant-garde who, in the 60s, imagined how their own country could be transformed and how implicit, in indirect way, Asia and the rest of the world could be transformed. And 6 years ago, we started this effort. And benefiting from the fact that all the members of the movement were still alive. So what we discovered is kind of very, very surprising. For instance, Kikutaka, one of the architect here, turned out to be a radical anti-democrat. No matter of the fact that he was a star in his field and an absolutely modern architect carrying feudal values. And so we, as Westerners, I think we heard at the end of this movement a lot of confessions and a lot of heartfelt statements that these architects made at the end of, of their lives. But we also had to, of course, do things that were kind of less legal. This is the architecture. And if you kind of remember the kind of first part of my lecture, where I mentioned the competitiveness between architects, how each of us are played out against each other through the private sector, What became very important in looking at the metabolist is kind of really looking at the last moment that architects could together form an alliance, could collaborate, even though they retained their own character, their own interest, could still be operating in a loose association of people kind of serving the public good. So for me, it is also kind of looking retroactively at a utopia of a different kind of architectural community. Here you see that kind of intimate. This image would be totally impossible today. And basically that is perhaps a tragedy. We are also looking at this book at the kind of first time that architecture tangled with media, with modern mass media, and discovered that there was almost an insatiable appetite for detail about these Japanese architects in the kind of mass media, but also in the new medium of television, an incredible ability to make them look extremely good and extremely promising. This is a kind of enactment of an idea, unfolding of an idea that I think, again, in current media is almost unthinkable today. This is Kurokawa, and this is a kind of basically definitely a dandy, but also a fanatical worker. He wrote 100 books and made 450 reports about extremely serious subjects. But here is everything that he carries in his pocket, carried as news in the Japanese media. And what we finally discovered is perhaps the most interesting revelation, that these architects were not acting alone, that they were not there as kind of individuals, but that they, to some extent, were figments of the imagination of the state. Now, it's not very often that the word state and imagination are mentioned in a single breath, but that was nevertheless the case here. And this is the puppet master, Sunoshimo Kobe, who basically, from the very beginning, conceived of this group, supported the group with an enormous amount of money, enormous amounts of work, and generated a cohesive picture from the public sector of how the country of Japan should be changed. So in every sense, the absolute opposite of the current situation. So with that, I want to end this kind of presentation of our current concerns. Thank you.
A couple of questions.
Rem, for the last couple of minutes, I've been trying to think of what I would say about this talk. And I haven't heard too many talks like this. I've heard a lot of talks. It was stimulating, thought-provoking. It was amusing, terrifying, and mostly thought-provoking. I want to thank you again for this talk. So we have time for a few questions, and there's microphones here and one up on the top in the balcony. So if you'd come to the microphone, we have just a little bit of time, but Rem has graciously agreed to take some questions.
Before I take questions, I would like to out the people that were called collaborators by the previous speakers, and say that the Cornell building is the creation of Shoshi Gamatsu and Ziad Shahab and myself, and that they're here in the auditorium.
This is dangerous, one of our trustees and an architect as well.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. I am fascinated by your idea of the architect going back to be the originator of ideas and the beginning of the construction process, and the master architect, the one that really comes up with the problem that we have to solve in our society. How can we change our educational programs to help that happen? That's fine. How do you suggest we do that?
Okay, I will answer your question, but without agreeing with your terminology. We definitely don't feel like master architects. On the contrary, all of this is more an effort of orchestrating modesty, or using modesty actually to explore things, and powerlessness to explore things and to try to find a kind of platform from which you can be active. But it is true that that I personally have thought about how to educate generations and professionals that can deal with this new situation, and that my own solution has been based on really only two discoveries. First of all, I think what schools do not do is that they're all welcoming kind of more and more nationalities, but they haven't really thought about what the consequence is of all these nationalities together and what the potential is of all these nationalities. When I was in Harvard for the first time, I saw a teacher talk to a class about rehabilitating abandoned harbor piers in Boston Harbor. And looking at the class, the vast majority came from Asia, and the idea of anything abandoned is not really Asian, and rehabilitation is also not very Asian. So there was a clear misfit between the claim of the teacher to be able to teach something of relevance, but the teacher also was not thinking of the student body as a new kind of student body with knowledge, because of course a Singaporean student is at least an expert in Singapore, and a Chinese student is at least an expert on China. And so in my own educational practice, I've reversed the kind of pretension of a teacher as somebody who is in possession of knowledge which he is under certain conditions willing to share, but simply declared a condition of shared ignorance vis-a-vis certain projects and subjects that we wanted to explore together, and basically developed a way of doing research which in relatively short period can actually generate new knowledge, and that has been my own intuition that education should become generating knowledge and how you generate knowledge more than what we have now is a transaction between an old body of knowledge that becomes dissipated and distributed.
I got a couple questions I might ask. Just quickly take the prerogative. One comment, I guess, the idea of going back and soaking up some more knowledge every 10 years bears an uncanny resemblance in the medical profession now. In the more modern generations, you have to be retested every 10 years. I thought it was fascinating. I know there's others who are probably wondering, you zoom by a picture of one of our previous presidents. Was there something special about
that? He was. I mean, actually, it required too much explanation. but it was actually, in a certain way, a high point of our career as political consultants. Because it's Bush talking on a lectern that we designed.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Bush visiting Brussels, and this was our new logo for Europe, kind of a barcode where every nation is kind of represented. And so on this visit, and so this was for me the closest we came to penetration of the political process in the political moment.
We have one. Well, I guess
and
we can.
Kind of basically, so we have our two. Barcode versus the lapel.
So one question down here, and then the last question will be up there, please.
You speak about the future of cities and buildings and architects' role. How does sustainability come in with that? Because that's like a big issue in terms of like sustainability, like energy consumption and.
Well, I think that the typical answer is that I think that architects have been the profession that has been maybe not in practice during the market economy, but in terms of thinking, the most responsible in terms of thinking about sustainability from the Roman period onward, but also with a kind of explosion perhaps in the 60s. People like Buckminster Fuller and Spaceship Earth speak for themselves. And it is only unfortunate that sustainability now has become a kind of token language that any architect needs to, a base that every architect needs to touch. So I would love to come back at some point and to talk about our own involvement in energy, but you have to assume that it's a constant underlying involvement. But it is at this moment not something of a kind of new territory that we're, but you have to assume that it is an underlying kind of motive.
Thank you. And the last question, there was one up there. Is there still one up? Yeah, please.
Yeah. Hi. So I can't stop thinking about the Indian guy doing the remote control cow milking or the guy who bought the Tuscan village. And those seem to be symptoms of like the same terrifying thing. And can architecture or art or something work to like slow down whatever that thing is?
Well, I think I don't know whether we can slow it down. I think we are all part of the kind of same massive movement of modernization, but I think that there are three areas of action. You can criticize it, and perhaps in certain cases you can criticize it so well that you kind of change the practice. You can find intelligence ways perhaps to be involved in the very process, so that without acceleration you can maybe deviate it or give it a direction. Of course, the third option would be to simply become a kind of utopian and dedicate yourself to doing the absolute opposite, perhaps on and give demonstrations that the opposite is possible, but on a kind of small and personal scale.
One more thank you to Rem Koolhaas.
Thank you. Thank you.